This is an ABC podcast.
Good morning and welcome to AM. I'm Kim Landers. On the program today, a country divided again. Travellers face long waits at state borders and unexpected stints in quarantine. Welcome to 2021 as the COVID-19 chaos continues.
That fear of being locked down again after what we had been through. You know, we don't know when we're going to see Mum and Dad again. And it was just so rushed.
And brace for disruptions. It's been 4 years since Britain's voted to leave Europe. Now the impact of Brexit becomes a reality. There's been New Year's Eve turmoil as thousands of people have had holiday plans thrown into chaos by rapidly closing state borders. Victoria and South Australia have shut their borders with New South Wales. Some people waited hours at border crossings last night as they rushed to get home, and traffic is backed up again this morning. And Western Australia has locked out Victorians. It's all happening as authorities once again race to put a lid on COVID-19 outbreaks in Sydney and Melbourne. Annie Guest reports.
When Melbourne woman Sarah, her partner, three children and a dog rushed home from Albury overnight, it was chaos.
We are bumper to bumper waiting to go through the checkpoint.
They were among many cutting short holidays to race home ahead of a new compulsory quarantine from midnight last night, or worse, before the Victorian border closes to all of New South Wales tonight.
We don't want to have to quarantine for 14 days with three children. Both my husband and I are having to work, and just that fear of being locked down again after what we had been through. Oh, but it is so triggering. And also too, I'm just sad because, you know, we don't know when we're going to see Mum and Dad again. Like, and it was just so rushed. Rush the kids. I mean, they're sad. Like, it's just upheaval again. Everything's just so uncertain.
Victoria's border rules come amid growing community cases of COVID-19 linked to Greater Sydney's coronavirus outbreak. Acting Premier Jacinta Allen says it was a difficult decision to make.
This is not an easy choice, closing borders, and certainly not one that we wanted to be making and announcing on a day that is supposed to be about celebrating.
Other state borders are starting to snap shut. Among them, Western Australia is now closed to Victorians, and South Australia is resetting a hard border with New South Wales. But Queensland hasn't joined them. Instead, the Chief Health Officer released a statement urging people against unnecessary travel south. That surprises Professor Mike Toole from the Burnett Institute, who welcomes the swift action by Victoria.
So I think it's highly justified. But my worry is the delay between the time those first three cases attended a Thai restaurant and when they were diagnosed. It was 10 days. So they've been circulating in the community all over eastern Melbourne.
In New South Wales, where Sydney's new Inner West cluster continues to grow, Professor Toole fears worse is to come after last night's festivities.
And although the Premier has pleaded with people not to mingle, not to sing, not to hug, not to kiss, imagine after a few drinks how hard that would have been for the bartenders and the safety marshals to stop people doing that.
Among those being careful was 23-year-old chef Chris, who invited four friends to his home in inner Sydney's Darlinghurst.
I guess if you have a more intimate crowd of 5 to 10, it's a little bit more safe as opposed to going out to a bar or a restaurant. So in that aspect, yes, I feel a little bit more safe, but it's obviously down to who comes to your house. I guess in some ways you almost have to treat it like your own venue, you know.
It's an attitude encouraged by Dr. Kerry Chant, the New South Wales Chief Health Officer.
COVID potentially will change our lives at all times, and it may be something like the flu where we have to learn how to manage it with the tool of having a vaccine for literally years to come.
But epidemiologist Professor Toole thinks more can be done.
I note that the Chief Health Officer and the Premier daily encourage people to wear masks, so they must believe that they work.
He's also renewed calls for a ban on crowds at next week's cricket test.
Two or three or four or five infected people in that crowd of 24,000 could create a super spreading event.
Professor Mike Toole from the Burnet Institute ending Annie Guest's report with additional reporting by Emily Burke and Gavin Coote. Well, as we've heard, the fresh border closures have come as a massive shock to some. Western Australia is once again being very tough, reinstating a hard border with Victoria, which means anyone who's arrived in the state from there since December 21st will now have to get a test and self-isolate for 14 days. After surviving COVID herself and getting through the Melbourne lockdown, one woman, who we'll call Elizabeth, moved to WA for a fresh start, but came back to Melbourne for Christmas. She was on her way to get a COVID test in southern WA when she spoke with our reporter Emily Burke.
I haven't seen my family in, I think, 8 months. So we went back to visit them, which was really good, and I'm so glad we got to. Now we're back and have to go into quarantine again.
This isn't your first time in quarantine, is it?
No, it's not.
What does this mean now for you?
We have my partner's best friend's wedding, who he's best man at next Friday, so there's every chance we won't make that.
This isn't you being inconvenienced. This is pretty close to home for you, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. And, you know, we've been through a lot with this, and we're smart about it. We do the right thing, and we're not going to put ourselves at risk just for anything.
But this is really personal.
It is, yeah. Back in July, I contracted COVID-19 through my workplace.
In Victoria?
In Victoria, yes. And it... yeah, it should never have happened, and it didn't. Yeah, we've been paying for it ever since.
You moved to the West to shake it all off.
Yeah.
How are you going to mark New Year's Day?
I just think we hit the reset button and just, you know, look onwards and upwards and just shake it off, and it is what it is, but we just hope for the best.
WA resident Elizabeth speaking to Emily Burke. Well, despite the year it's been, retailers are ending on a pretty positive note with a spike in sales in the final months. But with growing COVID cases in Sydney and Melbourne, the hospitality sector, which was already struggling to recover, is bracing for an uncertain start to 2021, as Bridget Fitzgerald reports.
There's a buzz of activity on this shopping strip in the Perth suburb of Victoria Park. Marshall Martin welcomes a group of shoppers having a browse through his store. Lucky for him, there's been plenty of customers through the doors lately. In fact, he's up on last year.
Around about 30% up from the 1st of November through to the end of December.
Were you expecting that?
I didn't know what to expect. It was 2020. I think good luck helps a bit. We had a good website, and that went astronomical. It was wonderful.
So those online sales really helped you through?
Oh, for 2 months they didn't help, they were.
That was it?
Yeah, that was it, but it was a very big it.
Boxing Day's sales have been robust with a significant shift to online.
Paul Zara is the CEO of the Australian Retailers Association. Though the official Boxing Day figures won't be out until later this month, the forecast strong retail spend is expected to come to fruition, largely thanks to online sales.
We definitely saw, as expected, a reduction in overall foot traffic, but we're still forecasting the $19.5 billion to be spent by Australians across the country, and that's an increase of 3.9% on last year.
But for businesses that can't operate online, the economic pain of 2020 is set to continue.
Hospitality forecast to be down 16.7%, which is quite a whopping decrease for this post-Christmas period. We can't see the light at the end of the tunnel at this point.
And rising case numbers in New South Wales and the outbreak in Melbourne has once again put the sector on edge.
Couldn't sleep last couple of days when Sydney started. If we go through another lockdown like we did before, that would be end of all my businesses.
Jesse Singh's a chef and restaurateur with businesses in Melbourne, Sydney and the US. The threat of further restrictions hangs over him while he's still recovering from the extended Melbourne lockdown, unable to properly staff his restaurants.
There is no tourists coming, no backpacker coming. There's not many international students. a lot of people, casual people, fled Victoria. They went up to Queensland or New South Wales during the first lockdown. So right now we are operating 60% less staff.
Having spent less time in lockdown on her side of the border, Sydney publican Maureen Thornett is feeling a little more confident despite some New Year's Eve cancellations.
With the recent outbreak, people did get, I guess you could say, spooked again, realising that this virus is out there and that we need to be careful. I think 2021 is still going to be a challenging year, but I just feel we've got to stay optimistic.
Back in Perth, even in a state that's been relatively unaffected by the pandemic, Marshall Martin remains wary of what the new year could hold.
Who knows? I think we've been very lucky. I'd hope to be lucky for a little longer. That'd be good.
Perth shop owner Marshall Martin ending Bridget Fitzgerald's report. Well, of all the changes you might expect with a new year, you might not have picked this one. We've got a different version of the national anthem. It's the tiniest of changes, just one word, but 143 years after it was first composed, the Prime Minister says the tweak is being made in what he calls the spirit of unity. Well, to explain the surprise update, our political reporter Claudia Long joins me. Claudia, tell us a little bit more about this change.
Good morning, Kim. Well, the second line of the anthem is from today, like you mentioned, going to be changed. It's changing from young and free to one and free. In a statement released last night at about 10:30 p.m. on New Year's Eve, the government said it's asked the Governor-General to agree to the change, like you said, in the spirit of unity, to reflect the long history of First Nations people, because obviously young doesn't accurately reflect the 65,000-year history of First Nations people who were on this continent for millennia before British colonisation. The Governor-General, David Hurley, has signed off on the change, so it will be in place from today. And it's the first change to the anthem since the 80s, when then-Prime Minister Bob Hawke requested a change.
So, Claudia, who did the government consult about this change?
Well, Kim, so far, it appears that primarily politicians have been consulted about this change. There hasn't been a formal consultation process yet with any First Nations groups. We have seen for some time now a number of politicians from across the political spectrum calling for this line in the anthem to be changed so that it can better reflect our history and modern Australia. That includes New South Wales Premier Gladys Berejiklian and opposition leader Anthony Albanese. For now, those on the consultation list include the Federal Cabinet, State Premiers, Governors of the States and the Speakers of both the House and the Senate.
That's our political reporter Claudia Long at Parliament House in Canberra. Well, it's been more than 4 years since Britain's voted to leave the European Union, but from today they'll start to see the major effects of Brexit. They'll no longer be able to live and work freely in Europe, and despite a recent trade deal, they're being told to brace for disruptions. Nick Dole reports from Dover near the English Channel.
The clock is ticking.
The UK government's launched an advertising blitz, urging Britons to prepare for big changes.
New rules on exports, imports, tariffs, data and hiring.
From today, the Brexit transition period ends, so Britain's officially out of the customs union. It means thousands of trucks heading to France will be subject to new paperwork, and the goods on board will need customs declarations and certifications that they never did before.
But inevitably, it's the paperwork that's going to be the problem. There is going to be more paperwork for us to export our cheese.
Robin Betts runs a Kent cheese dairy and sends gourmet cheddar across Britain and across the Channel to France. He spoke to AM from his cheese cave, filled with dozens of rounds of his prized product, Winterdale Shore.
And what do the French think of your cheddar?
Well, it goes into Paris, so which is quite a surprise when we did get that call, to be honest.
Robin Betts says he's worried that after the New Year lull, the new border checks will create a logjam at the nearby port of Dover. Last week, it was brought to a standstill when the French government shut the border due to the new strain of COVID-19. Thousands of trucks queued up for days to reach France. While that sort of chaos is highly unlikely to be repeated, Robin Betts says any delays could be costly.
We have an overnight courier that goes into France. Now, if there's too many delays, that won't become an overnight courier. That'd probably be a weekly kind of journey, you know, and that won't work with a perishable good like cheese.
There are also major immigration changes. From today, UK citizens who head to Europe won't be free to live and work there, and vice versa for Europeans coming to Britain. Those already there can apply to stay, but new arrivals will have to compete for visas under a points-based system. That's a big concern for Britain's aged care sector, which has more than 100,000 carer vacancies and has traditionally relied on European workers to help fill the roles. Nadra Ahmed from the National Care Association says European workers are more important than ever as nursing homes battle COVID-19.
Over the Christmas period, we've had a number of calls from providers who've just basically said to us, we're on our knees. Is there anywhere we can get staff? They're absolutely desperate. So I think staffing is a major issue.
A pre-Christmas trade deal means there'll be tariff and quota-free commerce between the UK and EU. But Jill Rutter from the UK think tank, the Institute for Government, says the deal didn't cover services industries that make up 80% of the British economy.
If you're trying to provide a professional service, so if you've got a UK qualification, there's one carve-out for lawyers, but if you're a UK qualified accountant or an architect, you won't be able to use that qualification in the EU anymore.
Boris Johnson's government says people should expect a few bumps in the road, but that Brexit is the will of the people. Even at a time of great economic uncertainty, Mr. Johnson insists Britain is better off alone. This is Nick Dole in Dover, reporting for AM.
Indonesia is introducing a breathalyzer test that can electronically smell coronavirus and detect coronavirus infection in under 2 minutes. It's already been used in 3 hospitals in Java. It's less accurate than standard tests, but desperately needed in a country where testing rates are among the lowest in the world. Indonesia correspondent Ann Barker reports.
It looks and works like your average roadside breathalyzer. The breath is blown through a tube into a bag for testing. But instead of alcohol, the Genose device, developed at Yogyakarta's Gajah Mada University, is testing for COVID-19. Research leader Professor Kuat Triana says the device is like an electronic nose that can effectively smell coronavirus in breath and detect a COVID-19 infection in under 2 minutes. The breath is sucked into sensors which can read the pattern of COVID-19, he said. COVID positive and negative are easily differentiated as long as we have the artificial intelligence to read it. The coronavirus would be different from, say, influenza, tuberculosis or pneumonia. A single test, he says, would cost just a few dollars, much cheaper than the standard PCR tests, and produces a result in minutes instead of hours or days. Indonesia has now granted a distribution permit for the device and hopes to roll out thousands of them by February to increase mass testing of COVID-19 at hospitals, airports and other public places. We need faster screening to prevent people getting infected, says Indonesia's Minister for Research and Technology, Bambang Brojonegoro. This will accelerate the detection process and mitigate the risk of the pandemic spreading. The breathalyzer, like other rapid tests, is less reliable, but as COVID-19 infections and deaths continue to surge, Indonesia is desperate to stop the spread. In the right place, 10,000 Genose units can test 1.2 million people a day, says Professor Kuat. That would be the highest testing rate in the world. Professor Catherine Bennett, the chair of epidemiology at Deakin University, says research elsewhere in the world supports the idea.
The science, I think, does back it up. The question is how well it can distinguish COVID from other lung infections, for example, and they're the things they need to really look at.
Despite around 740,000 infections so far and 22,000 deaths, Indonesia has one of the lowest testing rates in the world and struggles to meet the WHO's minimum recommendation of 1,000 tests a week for every 1 million people.
Here we're comparing testing that might not be as accurate as the PCR, but it's absolutely better than nothing.
Indonesia is not the only country to develop a COVID breathalyzer. Researchers in Singapore, Britain, France, and even Australia are currently developing devices that rely on similar intelligence.
Indonesia correspondent Ann Barker. Well, previously secret cabinet papers from the year 2000 give a glimpse into how the Howard government at the time was grappling with the introduction of the GST and the mammoth logistical effort of staging the Sydney Olympics. From Canberra, his political reporter Matthew Doran.
Spinning around,
The dawn of a new millennium and a country full of nationalistic pride, with Kylie Minogue topping the charts and preparations well and truly underway to host the biggest show on earth.
I think it was great delight and anticipation that Australia was hosting this great event.
John Anderson was Deputy Prime Minister and Nationals leader in 2000.
It was tempered only by a deep concern that we leave no stone unturned to keep people safe.
The Atlanta Games 4 years earlier had been rocked by terrorism, and organisers on this side of the Pacific were keen to avoid a repeat. Cabinet papers show offers of support from American authorities were taken up, even though a request for the security detail for then-President Bill Clinton's daughter Chelsea to bring their own weapons into the country was denied. Australia's 16 gold medal haul following months after the federal government's success in delivering tricky public policy. The implementation of the GST, complete with slick advertising campaign, dominated cabinet discussions.
The Commonwealth government is introducing a new tax system.
Detail about planning for the new tax regime is included in the papers in what some historians have hailed a triumph of public policy rollout. Then-Treasurer Peter Costello was pleased when asked about it on Melbourne radio days after it kicked in.
I think it went as well, probably better than anybody could have imagined.
Were you ready for bedlam?
I wasn't saying that there was going to be bedlam.
Something that didn't go to plan was Australia's brief flirtation with normalising diplomatic ties with North Korea. Then-Foreign Minister Alexander Downer seemed upbeat when he arrived on the ground in Pyongyang in November of 2000.
We can make a contribution to bringing North Korea in from isolation. I think,
but it wasn't to be, as John Anderson now recalls.
I would say a touch of hopefulness tinged with naivety that turned out to be somewhat unrealistic.
Cabinet's interest in foreign affairs stretched from North Korea to Australia's island neighbours, as ministers were forced to confront the possibility of a deteriorating situation in East Timor, where Australian troops were leading the UN peacekeeping mission, as well as planning an exit strategy from the fledgling nation. All the while, they were keeping an eye on instability in Fiji and the Solomons. Closer to home, the surge in the number of asylum seekers coming to Australia by boat was making detention centres in places like Woomera, South Australia, a tinderbox.
Detainees armed themselves with makeshift spears and slingshots.
Cabinet agreed to tough new punishments for those trying to escape or incite violence inside detention centre fences, even though the departments of Prime Minister and Cabinet, Attorney General and Foreign Affairs all voiced concerns about whether they were proportionate. Debate over the appropriate path towards reconciliation was front and centre as hundreds of thousands of people marched across the Sydney Harbour Bridge. But Cabinet was worried any statement about reconciliation shouldn't be seen as legally enforceable, and Prime Minister John Howard didn't join the march.
Let the alien begin.
Issues such as Indigenous disadvantage are still cause for concern 2 decades on, and the Cabinet papers also show the germination of another idea that's lingered for years to come. An emissions trading scheme. Cabinet historian Chris Wallace says then-Environment Minister Robert Hill's proposal for a market-based mechanism to deal with carbon emissions had broad support in Cabinet, but did face some opposition from Industry Minister Nick Minchin.
And the distinctive thing about these papers is they don't show any science versus politics binary. That's not the case.
The matter is largely unresolved today, something John Anderson laments.
Oh, I would very much like it to have been less ugly and less divisive and better informed by reality, I have to say as well.
Given how the world changed so dramatically the following year with the September 11 attacks, the former Deputy Prime Minister looks back at the year 2000 with a certain fondness.
The Olympic Games were a very high point for Australia in the year 2000, which in many ways was to turn out to be the last year of normality.
Matthew Doran with that report. And that is AM for today. AM's executive producer is Mike Edwards, associate producer Gavin Coote. Technical production and web publishing by Ingrid Wagner, Mark Cash and David Lawford. Thanks for your company. I'm Kim Landers.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.